I read the statistics that this rate is so high in Black community, like schizophrenia is high in Black community. Alcoholism is high in Indigenous community. Society, we have pathologized the people. Instead of coming from a trauma-informed angle and saying it's not what is wrong with you, but what wrong happened to you.
This is Justice by Design, where I talk to the people who are finding real solutions to the problems that we face as a society. And I don't know about all of you, but I have been thinking a lot about mental health in these days since the election. I've been thinking about taking care of my own and how important it is for all of us to keep that front of mind, particularly people who face unique challenges, unique perspectives, and unfortunately, right now, unique hate. I've been thinking a lot about Islamophobia, what we've seen already happening in record numbers since the Israel attack of October 7th. We've seen the rhetoric rising in our own discourse here in America, as well as in other countries. And to talk a little bit more about how what can be done, how to protect the mental health of people who are facing this kind of hate and discrimination, I am honored to be joined by Dr. Farah Abbasi, joining me from my home state of Michigan. Dr. Abbasi, thank you so much.
Thank you so very much for having me on this show. Look forward to the conversation.
So before we get started, just introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them what you do there at Michigan State University.
So I'm assistant professor of psychiatry, and I'm also faculty for Muslim Studies Center, South Asian Studies Center, and beside that, for the last 20 years, I am doing work around Muslim mental health. So all the mental health challenges that I'm seeing in the Muslim community. I have the annual Muslim Mental Health Conference, and now we have a consortium at Michigan State focused very much on research and community development kind of collaboration.
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking time. I know you're very busy. You know, I've been thinking a lot about Islamophobia generally, because of what we've been seeing, what's been happening on college campuses, what happened when a sitting US senator said something that I thought was horrifically Islamophobic to someone testifying before the Senate a couple months ago. I'm not going to repeat the comment. It went viral. I think most of our listeners already know. And that is on top of what has already been happening. You know, we've had an election now of a president who not only promised the first time, campaigned on banning Muslims from entering the country, but has just been re-elected. So I want to start just asking a big question, is how can we understand, given that Islam has been a part of the American story since the nation's inception, why are we in this place and why is this particular type of bigotry so persistent?
Where do I start? First of all, you know, the heartbreaking fact, almost a 70% uptick in hate crimes in the last 1 year. And I also see that as the anti-Semitism rise, so does the Islamophobia. But also, at this point, I take exception to calling it Islamophobia. Because, you know, with phobia, phobias are irrational fears, but the triggers are something that can are deemed dangerous, or can we feel like that this can harm me or affect my life or something like that. But phobia also has an end. like you can treat it, you can do exposure prevention therapy or something, you know?
Yes.
What we are seeing is almost like, I would say, what we see with racism, what we see with toxic stress, what we see with, so, you know, if you look at the prejudice scale, this is not implicit bias, this is not explicit bias, this is really prejudiced behavior. So I'll give you some facts. Muslim kids are bullied at twice the rate of national bullying rate, so twice the higher rate. And what we know is that usually bullying is done at in academic or school settings when the teachers are not present or when there is not somebody in authority present, and then there is bullying happening. What we see is unique is that this bullying is being done by teachers, by professors, like you mentioned the incidents, people in power.
Yeah.
So that also, then there is now, if we look at some of the research coming out, that what's the least thriving faith community right now, you would see the name of the Muslims. But then also what we are seeing is twice high rate of suicidal ideations in Muslim youth. So you wonder, it's very easy to adopt the narrative of the otherization, that if the system is working for me and the system is not working for someone else, then the problem is not with the system. The problem is with the other party. The otherization, right? So
yes.
System honors me, system respects me, I get benefited from the system, then the problem is with you, that somehow you are not thriving, you are not doing well. We have always pathologized the subject versus the system.
Yeah.
So I fear now when I look at, I identify as a cultural psychiatrist, and I look at impact of racism, how racism has impacted generations and generations and generations. First of all, very much still embedded in our policies, in our structures, in our environment. So when I read the statistics that this rate is so high in Black community, like schizophrenia is high in Black community. Alcoholism is high in Indigenous community. Society, we have pathologized the people.
Yeah.
Instead of coming from a trauma-informed angle and saying it's not what is wrong with you, but what wrong happened to you.
Yeah.
So if you, sorry, go ahead.
No, I want you to continue. I was just thinking about, as you were speaking, responding to that trauma. For a lot of people, it's also not, it's not homogenous. If a lot of people who are dealing with anti-Islam trauma, they're dealing with anti-Black trauma perhaps too, or they're dealing with xenophobic trauma. I shouldn't use xenophobic either, fear of others trauma.
Really?
On top of that, and yeah, just talk a little bit more about that approach to it.
We all have intersectional identities, right? And by that, some parts of our identity could be empowering, but some parts of our identity make us very vulnerable. Like, yes, I'm a physician, but I am a woman, and I'm a woman of color. I'm an immigrant. So this intersectionality just gets played into our traumas as well. The traumas right now, what the minorities are feeling, including Indigenous population to Black population to newcomers to the country, I think it's layers of trauma that is not being talked about or being even validated. So, you know, there is a term in if you look at the impact of racism, there's a few terms that now I am kind of applying to this anti-Muslim rhetoric that's happening in the country. Is one thing is disconsciousness. You said something very beautiful in the beginning, right? That I think if love is learned, so is hate. So we only preserve the things that we love, and we only love the things that we know, and we only know the things that we are taught.
Wow.
So how does your brain create these associations? Mm-hmm. Is that the brain is designed to label things. That's how we survived as cavemen, right? You there was your brain that labeled it dangerous, comfortable, warm, loving, hate. So, like, you know, this memories are consolidated when they are associated with emotions. But then what happens is the impact of what we are being exposed to. So it's not no more that simple that I am not going to stand in front of a dinosaur because I'm going to be eaten up. It's not that simple anymore. So here, if you are being bombarded by messages that this person of this color, this ethnicity, this structure, or anybody that looks different than you is a danger to you. Stranger danger.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where your executive brain has labeled it that and send it to your emotional brain, which goes on a red alert when you see any of those triggers.
Yeah.
I was on airport, and there was a mother and a small child right in front of me. This is during COVID. The daughter was not wanting to wear the mask and turned around and asked the mother, why do we have to wear this mask? And she said, don't you know, sweetheart, some Chinese people brought this horrible virus to us. Do you think what just happened? You are teaching that child certain things.
Yeah. What to fear. And we just had an election where there was fear mongering was a winning message. Fear mongering of others in so many ways, including
political tool.
Yes. And it was victorious. It worked. So how, talk a little bit about the uniqueness in ensuring, helping people of the Muslim faith ensure that their mental health is strong. I mean, I know that can have a lot of cultural aspects. I know Black Americans, for example, for a very long time, it was not seeking mental health care was not something that we did. I mean, I do it. I love my therapist. I talked to him today. But talk about some of the unique things that you think about in terms of ensuring the mental health care of Muslims.
Definitely deep-seated stigma. So I think the conflict comes in two ways. One thing is you have model minority myth that you have to excel. Then you also are very afraid to acknowledge that there is something wrong with you because you are being rewarded for. So, you know, there's another term, John Henryism. that people of color have to work twice as hard to get half the validation. So you are being set up to work harder, but if you acknowledge your limitation, then you are the problem. So one thing is, how do we even come out and talk about that there could be something wrong with me, because already you are being another thing, imposter syndrome. Forever we were told, oh, people of color and minorities have imposter syndrome. No, forever we thought something was wrong with us, but it's generations of invalidation that has created internalized racism, has created this permanent sense of inadequacy. That system is working, system is good. Then if I falter, then I fail and something is wrong with me. So one thing is other people telling you, but then you internalize it. I'm sure you are aware of the experiment that black children were given two dolls to play with, black and white. And every time the child was asked to pick a doll, they would pick the white doll as the beautiful one. But when asked which doll looks like you, they pick the black one. Heartbreaking. You are ingraining this sense of inadequacy, right? Another piece is the disconsciousness. So it's forever we have talked about implicit bias as unconscious. What we are seeing right now is when you create these buzzwords, that's where the implicit bias comes, right? When you create this buzzword, black threat, immigrants taking us over, Chinese virus, these buzzwords, and then you are bombarded by these messages. So you develop a disconsciousness, that distorted truth. Half truths become your new reality. So, the way I see stigma work is, one thing is minorities are already under the pressure of this mental health stigma because they feel we can't talk about it. On the other hand, you don't trust the system to take care of you. There's a huge trust deficit. And this trust deficit then come out, what the research shows, that more the vulnerable population, less access of mental health services, underutilization of mental health services.
So how does your work break through that? How do you, because that
How
seems
do I
like a
break through?
lot.
First of all, and the biggest thing I'm challenging within myself, and within my community and within my colleagues, and I teach my students and residents, that is that forever the minorities were given the message, fly under the radar. Don't bring the focus on yourself. Invisibility ensures our safety. But do you know what happened? We started to lose our voice in that. To me, visibility is viability. We
Wow.
need to speak up. We need to stand not only for ourselves, but we have to be upstanders. We have to stand with all the vulnerable populations, not just Muslims, Black, LGBTQ. Indigenous population. So, very interesting. The narrative with this election was immigrant danger, 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 eating cats, dogs, taking over the country. Your forefathers were immigrants. People who are writing your constitution were immigrants, including Hamilton, right? And you in the disconsciousness is that you have indigenous people living here, but we are celebrating Columbus for discovering us. Yeah. Then the citizenship is centered on whiteness. Then the slaves who get freed get the citizenship. Then the women get the citizenship. And then the indigenous people get the citizenship.
Yeah.
So you have historically created a system that actually worked for few.
That was
we
how
talk
was
about
yeah.
equity, but if we look at the policies from the lens of justice, it's not equity we are practicing. So another thing is, one thing is I'm fearful of talking about my struggles. I don't trust the system to deliver care for me. But maybe I don't even have access to care.
Right.
So I am a big proponent of speaking up. Visibility is viability. There are no voiceless people. They are intentionally muted and deliberately unheard. And so, that has to change.
So how can, what can people do? You say be an upstander. How can we be better upstanders when it comes, particularly when it comes to standing up?
I think
to anti-Muslim hate?
For us, especially from, if we, I talk from Muslim mental health point of view, few things, we need safe places. First of all, we need to be a safe place, and we need safe places where we can normalize, validate, normalize trauma, validate trauma. So another term that we see is disenfranchised grief. No, you were never acknowledged for what you are going through, right?
Yeah.
So I think we need to let this grief out. We need to talk about the stigma, create awareness, acceptance, start with our own selves. We need to be authentic and truthful to ourselves first, but then having a voice, standing up, creating those safe places, like the Muslim Mental Health Conference is the safe place where we have very academic research being presented. And although it says Muslim mental health, it has religious sensibility, but we are not teaching religion. We are talking about how to do this work within the realms of a faith community. And 17 years of doing it, right now, I think it's almost like a movement. You have people practicing, identifying as Muslim mental health providers and wanting to just do practice focused on that community. We have a lot of research coming in. I wouldn't say we have achieved all the goals, but we are moving in the right direction. But I also see that right now mental health work is interdisciplinary. In the sense, you need to not only do the clinical work, you have to be academic, do the research, you have to be knowledgeable of the sensibility of the faith, bring faith leaders in this conversation, but also you have to be an advocate right now. You really have to focus on the policy aspect of the things as well. So it's a multi-layered work.
Yes. And there is a lot of work to do, but I thank you so much both for the work that you are doing and also for joining me this week to talk about this. Thank you, Dr. Abbasi.
Thank you so much.
You know, one thing that I'm really left with after the talk with Dr. Abbasi are two things she said, actually, two things. One is that visibility is viability. That's something I'm going to meditate on for a while. And also that it's important to be an upstander and to stand up in this moment. And those things are really important, but they also seem hard sometimes for mental health, which leads to the third thing that she said, is that we all need time to grieve, particularly people in marginalized communities, like those of the Muslim faith. In this moment, after we've gone through collectively what is for many of us a trauma. And so I wish that for all of you, that you give yourself that time to grieve. And then I want you to get back to the business of being visible, being an upstander, and realizing that even as we face difficulties, we need to take care of ourselves and we need to make sure that our neighbors have the support that they need to. And thank you for joining me this week on Justice by Design. Please follow this podcast wherever you get your pods and give me a 5-star rating, because you know why? Not just because you love me, but because that helps other people find the show and get access to all the wonderful people who I have here as guests, because this show is not about me. It's about all of you and all the people making Justice by Design. I will see you next week with another episode. Until then, take care of yourselves.